Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how are immigrant rights advocates reacting to President Biden's announcement of a new program aiming to shield spouses of U.S. citizens from deportation? And Latino voters aren't the Democratic stronghold they once were. How both parties are trying to capture the Latino vote. But first, clean energy advocates are accusing the Arizona Corporation Commission of trying to silence its critics. The controversy comes after the CorpCom voted to exempt a 200-megawatt power plant in Mojave County from environmental review, a move that upends 50 years of precedent in the way the commission has regulated power plants. Wayne Shetsky with KJZZ's Politics Desk broke the story, and he joins me now with more. Hi there, Wayne.
Good morning.
All right, so let's break this down. It's a little complicated. What happened with this vote to exempt this power plant from an environmental review?
State law requires that power plants above 100 megawatts have to obtain a certificate of environmental review from this committee that is a subcommittee of the Corporation Commission.
Okay.
But the state law that passed in the 70s actually defines a plant as a single generating station rated 100 megawatts or above. Mm-hmm. And what is happening now is a lot of these stations are like this one is four individual 50 megawatt stations. So they're all on the same site. They use a lot of the same facilities, but each one is rated at 50. So the company came to the Corporation Commission and said, under the letter of the law, we do not need to get this environmental review.
Hmm.
Historically, dating back to when this law was passed in the 70s, Corporation Commission has interpreted the law to mean a plant is any of these individual stations on a single site. However, they reversed that decision, much to the chagrin of lots of renewable energy proponents and things like that, because there was a legislative intent clause. That's where the legislature attaches a little piece saying this is what we're trying to do here.
Sure.
And so even though they wrote it in that way, requiring individual plants rated 100 or above, they said what we're trying to do is regulate major facilities
mm-hmm.
because we recognize that when we build these things, they have an effect on the environment, the communities around them.
Okay.
So that was kind of the disconnect. The Corporation Commission reversed that the 50 years of precedent and said, nope, letter of the law says that this doesn't require that environmental review, so we're not going to require it.
Okay, so it's broken down into four 50-watt plants, and then the Corporation Commission says, okay, it's okay to do this because they're smaller than the law says.
Correct.
All right, so why did the commissioners say this was okay? Like, critics are obviously saying otherwise. What was the commission's reasoning here?
They basically went to the letter of the law, which does say that, the definition of a plant in this law is individually rated units, which this has four individually rated units at 50 megawatts. So they do have some defense there. But again, that legislative intent clause, kind of where the legislature explains further what they're trying to do, kind of gives a little bit of credence to what the opponents of that decision were saying, which mm-hmm. is that, this was 50 years ago. Plants were built differently back then, but they're telling us what they were trying to do, which is regulate major facilities. This is a major facility. It should go undergo environmental review.
Okay, so some of these clean energy groups then issued press releases calling this out. Basically, they say this creates a loophole that would exempt most new gas plants from environmental review. Is that right?
Yeah, this happens all the time when a decision is made by any public body. The groups that were for it, the groups that were against it, issue their press releases either praising or criticizing the decision.
Mm-hmm.
Two of these groups, a Solar Energy Association and the Sierra Club, issued these press releases saying basically that the Corporation Commission is exempting now all similar facilities like this from environmental review moving forward,
mm-hmm.
And that it's giving a template for any utility that wants to do this. Basically, just subdivide up your power plants into these smaller units.
Okay. So, what would an environmental review here mean, Wayne? Like, what kinds of environmental concerns are there?
The state law spells out the types of things they can consider, and it's all the things you would think. It's looking at the surrounding communities, any homes, any things that are close to this, how this is going to impact them, how it's going to impact the nature around there, rivers, land, trees, the air quality, all of those type of things. And it kind of holistically looks at all of those things. We actually saw a power plant that was initially declined an expansion out by Coolidge with SRP a little while ago. There's a little bit of difference because the Corporation Commission doesn't regulate SRP in the same way that it regulates some others, but it was a similar environmental review, and they actually initially declined it, ultimately reversed it because of the impact it would have on a nearby community when it comes to pollution and things like that.
Yeah. The other part of the story is the general counsel, the new general counsel for the Corporation Commission here. Others have voiced concern about him and his role in this.
Yeah. The new general counsel, Tom Van Flein, he spent the last decade or so running Congressman Paul Gosar's office and being his general counsel. But he came to the Corporation Commission recently, actually wasn't licensed by the bar at this point when he actually came, doesn't have a lot of background in utilities. This is a very complicated agency that regulates utilities, but also financial securities, things like that. And actually the previous general counsel, who had been with the commission in various capacities for a few decades, she's currently suing them for discrimination. And one of the allegations she made is that he's being paid more than she was being paid on the job when she had been there for decades, and that she pointed to his resume, which doesn't really have a background in this kind of law.
What has he had to say about that?
He did not want to talk to me.
So is there any recourse, Wayne, for environmental advocates who say that this could have big implications for the way power plants are regulated down the road?
Yes, there is a process outlined. They basically will petition the Corporation Commission to reconsider this decision. They have about 2 weeks to do that once the official order is issued. And then the commission will vote whether or not to reconsider. If they do reconsider, have another hearing on it, have a vote on that. We'll see where that goes. If they don't reconsider, which is likely given what the vote was here, then the opponents have an opportunity to actually appeal to an actual judge in a court. And it will go to court, and the judge will look at the law and make that interpretation.
Okay, so much more to watch for here. KJZZ's Wayne Shetsky joining us from our politics desk. Wayne, thanks as always. Good reporting.
Yeah, thank you.
President Joe Biden made a major announcement on the immigration front yesterday, taking action that could provide eventual citizenship to 500,000 people living in the country without legal status. It comes on the heels of aggressive new asylum restrictions Biden put in place at the border just a few weeks ago that outraged many Democrats and immigrant rights advocates. The administration will allow certain undocumented spouses of U.S. citizens to apply for permanent residency and eventually citizenship. But there are some specific qualifications. An immigrant has to have lived in the country for 10 years as of Monday, so no one could get married now and qualify for the program. The program could also apply to about 50,000 undocumented children of parents who are married to U.S. citizens. Biden made the announcement yesterday at the White House at an event commemorating the 12th anniversary of the Obama-era Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program. And our next guest was there. Mario Montoya is a DACA recipient and a research analyst with the immigrant advocacy group Aliento. And I spoke with him more about it earlier this morning from Washington.
It was a wonderful experience to be able to be at the White House and just experience the new announcement. As a DACA recipient myself, the program has contributed to a lot of my life throughout my education, throughout my career, and having that peace of mind of not being deported. But it's at the same time a bittersweet kind of feeling because I know that the program is currently still in jeopardy and it remains closed for a lot of individuals that meet the criteria for it. Mm-hmm. So while it was really exciting to be there, at the same time, a little bit of bittersweetness with it as well, too.
Yeah, as it seems to be with DACA. So as you mentioned there, Biden also announced a big new initiative that his administration will allow certain spouses of U.S. citizens who are undocumented to apply for permanent residency and at some point citizenship. This could apply to 500,000 people, not quite as many as DACA did back in 2012, but quite a few. How big of an impact do you think this could have on people's lives, on people in your community? Do you know anyone who this might affect?
Yeah, there's a lot of individuals that are married currently that are undocumented and they are married to a U.S. citizen. I think this is going to really help individuals. It's going to ease the process of not having to go back to your country of origin and wait while you adjust status through there. Because sometimes that could take years, months at the fastest. But some individuals, if you want to do it right now, you do have to go back to your country of origin and you do have to wait. So this will help keep families together and not separate the families from each other, which is really great, in my opinion.
I wonder that because I think there is a common misconception that if you marry a U.S. citizen, you will, you know, get to stay. You'll get citizenship, that kind of thing. And that's not necessarily the way it works.
That's correct. So what you run into a lot of people that individuals that are undocumented, depending on your form, if you have an unlawful entry, it's what it's called. Mm-hmm. You have to ensure that that is adjusted. So that's what you need to go back to your country of origin and go ahead and get the paperwork to ensure that you get a proper lawful entry. So that has stopped a lot of individuals from being able to go ahead and get either their permanent resident status or get any form of citizenship at that point. Hmm. So this will help address the individuals that meet all the other requirements except for that one.
Yeah. So as I said, this could apply to 500,000 people or upwards of that number. But it all kind of hangs in the balance of the next election. Like if former President Donald Trump is elected, he could rescind the program. It's an executive action, just like DACA. Do you think this could set off a rush by organizations like yours to try to get as many people as you can to apply to this program quickly? The election's coming up here pretty soon.
Yeah, from what we heard yesterday at the White House, they said that the program will be released later in the summer. Mm-hmm. I think it's very depending to see exactly what the implementation is going to look like, what the requirements. We're going to need clear guidelines to see exactly what is going to be the process for individuals to apply. Meantime, like you mentioned, this is an executive order, so it is really important to keep in mind that this could be removed depending on who the next president is, but we, just like the DACA program as well, there might also be lawsuits. So if the lawsuits occur, this might stop it from even being implemented to begin with if an injunction is placed on the program.
Right. And I wanted to ask you about that because this is taking place as an executive action versus kind of an act of Congress, right, which is just like DACA and puts it in sort of a more tenuous position. I know as a DACA recipient, we've spoken before about the fact that you're always back and forth, right? There's always a limbo kind of situation in terms of your legal status or what might happen with the program. Will it stay? Will it go? Is this the same kind of feeling?
I hope for the individuals that this helps. I hope that they don't run into that same insecurity that is faced with DACA, unfortunately. But I'm not quite sure what is going to be argued in the courts. I hope that the Biden administration took the right approach and they ensured that this program is solid. So it would be good to defend in the courts, but from my understanding, they did take their due diligence to ensure that, but it's still unknown, and we'll have to wait to see what happens with any court challenges that might occur.
Hmm. This, of course, also comes on the heels of another major immigration announcement from the Biden administration, and an executive order also, but one kind of on the other end of the spectrum, one that suspends asylum claims on the border as long as migration remains at a high level. This was met with derision from many immigrant rights advocates. What was your response?
It was very disheartening to see because this population that's getting affected is people ultimately fleeing violence, fleeing prosecution. From my perspective, it was just very disheartening to see. I think it's really important and crucial to differentiate that the Biden administration at least has kept some pathways to asylum still open, even though they're very restrictive now and more narrow, but they are still able to at least have some sort of pathway for asylum seekers.
So this is an election year, and reports say Biden announcing this program to grant status to undocumented spouses could sort of balance out, right, this announcement about asylum at the border. Do you think it's enough?
I think this was done to, there's been a lot of conversation right now on new immigrants coming in or recent arrivals. I think this was, in a sense, the Biden administration trying to balance and keep in mind the long-term undocumented immigrants that have been here in the country. So I think he was trying to take a balanced approach to ensure that immigration is a huge issue with a lot of things to address with different individuals with different needs, correct? So I think he was trying to ensure that he could address issues for both populations that require different approaches.
So some immigrant rights organizations are saying, you know, this is what they needed from Biden to rally around him this coming election. Do you agree? Do you think that groups like yours, and we'll see more groups in Arizona campaigning for Biden, is this the kind of move that you needed from him?
I think it's a good step. Anything that makes the lives easier of individuals that have been here giving back to our community, that are working in our hospitals, a pathway and an ease of mind is always a good step. As far as if it's enough, I think it's very dependent. If you're impacted, this could be life-changing of not having to have your family separated. But if you are not eligible for these programs, to you, this might not seem like enough. So it's really dependent on the individual, I would say.
All right. We will leave it there for now. Mario Montoya, DACA recipient, research analyst with Aliento here in the Valley. Mario, thank you for coming back on the show. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, what ants can teach us about collaboration? We'll meet an ant researcher who explains why we're not so different from these social insects. But first, this is the Latino century, according to our next guest. In fact, it's the title of his new book. Mike Madrid is a longtime political consultant, co-host of the Latino Vote podcast, and author of the new book, The Latino Century, How America's Largest Minority is Transforming Democracy. He says Latino voters are becoming the most important voting bloc in the country, and both parties are failing them. I spoke with him more about it, beginning with the cover of the book, which features a portrait he painted, a Latino version of the famous American Gothic.
There's an interesting moment when you're writing a book where you get a request from the graphics department, you know, asking what you want the cover to look like. And for many years now, I have been exploring kind of the blending of traditional American iconography with Latino imagery, in part because that's, you know, a manifestation of my work and what I research and write on. And the other is because that's just what's happening every day in the country. Mm-hmm. So I had painted a few years ago this painting of the Grant Wood's American Gothic mm-hmm. painting with a Latino family, and call it Mexican American Gothic. And I sent that to the graphics department, and they said, we love this. And I was like, well, that was just an idea as to what I was looking for. And they're like, no, we've never had, Simon Schuster's never had a political book where the author was also the cover artist. So this would be a first. So there you go.
That's really cool. And it does kind of segue well into what we're talking about here, because as you said, this is such a, not just a part of your work, but a part of the political and the cultural conversation happening in the country right now. Begin for us, Mike, with a little bit about the massive growth that we have seen in the Latino population and in the diaspora, basically, in the last several decades.
Sure. So in 8 short years, America, for the first time in our history, will be a non-white majority country, driven almost entirely by the growth in the Latino population, Latino electorate. This is no longer a function of immigration. This is almost all U.S.-born domestic growth. So there's no wall that can be built to stop the demographic change. It's here. It's happening. I think it's a very positive attribute to our democracy and to our country. We are in very short order going to start seeing extraordinarily fast demographic transformation here in the country.
Yeah. Yeah. And as you say, like, this is already here. These are people who are already in the country. What does that mean about the sort of Latino voter, right? Like your podcast is called The Latino Vote, right?
Yeah.
It's changing so quickly and in ways that I don't think were predicted, right? At least by mainstream people in politics, but maybe you did.
Yeah, I've been talking about this for some time. I actually started to predict this rightward shift that was happening back in 2012 for purely demographic reasons. And that's really the most important distinction to understand, is more often than not, when we say the Latino vote is not monolithic, we're usually talking about kind of countries of origin or, you know, political diasporas that people have come from. But that's not capturing where the real change is happening. It's happening by generation. How far removed you are from the immigrant experience is definitive in determining your political beliefs. And what 80% now, 80% of all new Hispanic registrations are U.S. born, and they're English dominant, if not English exclusive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's moving. The main takeaway here is the transition with Latino voters is moving away from a racial and ethnically focused voter to a now an economic and pocketbook issue voter. And that explains why Latinos are moving near parity between Republicans and Democrats.
Right, which is a huge shift because Latinos have for so long been thought of as a solid Democratic voting bloc. You say those days are over.
They're completely over. They're very much in the rearview mirror and disappearing. Again, not necessarily because of what the parties are doing, although that is part of the story, but really more a function of demographics. Is Latinos, again, U.S. born, overwhelmingly U.S. born, non-college educated. This is the fastest growing segment of the blue-collar workforce. Mm-hmm. They are 30 years old or younger. If you look at some of the weaknesses that President Biden has in polling, it tends to be with younger voters. And there's no surprise, a huge overlap between Latinos and young voters. Latino mm-hmm. voters, as I say, is the youth vote. They're disaffected by both parties. And I think that's also an important distinction is Republicans are winning more and more Latino voters despite their best efforts, not because of them.
Right. That's an interesting point, because we've heard so much, at least in the last year or so, about Latino voters shifting to the right and this being a win for Republicans. You're basically making the argument that both parties are doing this wrong.
That's exactly the premise of the book. And there's a lot of data to suggest that that's the case. Arizona is a good example. Former Republican Governor Doug Ducey was dramatically overperforming with Hispanic Latino voters compared to where Donald Trump or a Kari Lake was getting. So the direction of the Republican Party is actually not conducive to greater Latino growth, or I should say, if some of those voices, those more extreme voices, were not in the party, the Republicans would be getting an even larger share of the vote.
Yeah. I want to talk about what the parties can do in a moment, but let me first ask you about immigration and all of this, because another kind of counterintuitive thing that you talk about in your research and in this book is that this is not the main issue for most Latino voters anymore. But is the Democratic Party scrambling to figure out how to deal with the border, how to address immigration affecting this?
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, look, immigration has never been a priority issue for Latinos in the past 30 years of looking at this issue and polling and working in the community. It's an important issue, but it's not a top priority. And Democrats are struggling, especially as the Democrats move away from working class voters. Latinos are the fastest growing segment of the working class. And I say that because the education divide is the largest demarcation of political behavior in the country. College educated voters are rapidly moving to the Democratic Party. Non-college educated voters are moving equally as rapidly towards the Republican Party. And Latinos are kind of caught up in that coalition realignment.
That's so interesting. So yes, it's more about class than it is about race or ethnicity here. So what should the parties be doing? What would you be advising them, or are you advising them as you work in your politics here?
Yeah, this and the first time in 35 years I'm not working on a presidential campaign or partisan effort. So those days are behind me. Let me say real quickly, housing is central to all of this. Both 1 in 5 Hispanic men are employed in the residential construction space or affiliated industries. That is a jaw-dropping statistic. And at a time when interest rates in the past 4 years have tripled and the value of our currency has devalued by about 20%, these voters are getting socked really hard economically in the gut. That's going to have to be addressed. There's going to have to be a Marshall Plan for housing to address not only the construction jobs and related jobs that come from that industry, but perhaps just as importantly, the affordability of housing, where Latinos as a much younger demographic are taking those first steps into home ownership and aren't able to get into a home. That's a problem both on the workforce end and the consumer end.
Let me ask you lastly here, because you have a big picture question that you're addressing in this book, this broad kind of scope of history question about what the rise of Latino voters will do in the country. Like, is it going to create and continue to create a hyperpartisanship that we're seeing already, or will we see some kind of new pluralism, right? What's your answer to that? What's your hope?
Well, the first thing to understand is Latinos are the moderate voters in both parties, and they're forcing both parties away from the extremist elements which have consumed both the right and the left. But the second, perhaps most important consideration is that Latinos are a much more optimistic community than any other of the race or ethnicities in the country. They have much higher levels of trust and confidence in our social institutions. That is the very basis for which a democracy and a society is working So we are entering this time where there's this very deep concern about the fragility of the American experiment, about whether or not democracy is strong enough to work in the future. And fortunately, we have this answer literally inside of us. Our own DNA as Americans is changing to be more culturally supportive of these institutions, a more positive outlook on the future, and more confidence in America and the American way of life.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. Mike Madrid, GOP political consultant, co-host of the Latino Vote podcast. The new book is The Latino Century. Mike, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks. It's always a pleasure being with you. Thank you.
The State Department of Health Services says as of this weekend, there were nearly 6,800 confirmed and probable cases of valley fever reported in Arizona so far this year. In 2022, the most recent year for which the department has complete data, there were more than 9,500 cases here. Arizona is a hotspot for the fungus that causes valley fever. Our next guest says half of all U.S. infections are in Maricopa County. And there's now a new tool that aims to help track those cases. Dr. John Galgiani is a physician and professor of medicine at the University of Arizona College of Medicine in Tucson. He's also the founding director of the Valley Fever Center for Excellence there. He spoke with my co-host Mark Brody more about this, and they started with what things look like now in terms of the number of cases that have been seen around Maricopa County relative to recent years.
Well, your question is really interesting, and the idea that is underlying your question is that valley fever is sort of seasonal. And I have actually been thinking that it pretty much was seasonal, but it turns out seasons are like influenza. You get seasons of influenza. It turns out valley fever does come and go. There are periods when it's a lot more intensely in the community than other times. But that depends on the year. And it is driven primarily by weather factors, although other factors come into that as well. And since the weather is different from year to year, it turns out when valley fever occurs throughout the year is quite variable. And I think what has been seen with the data coming into Maricopa County in the past 8 or 10 months is there was an unexpected rise in cases late in 2023 and carried on through the front end of 2024. But then over the last 2 or 3 months, and I think – although this is unproven, I think it might be because of the rains we had, the unexpectedly high rains back in March or something like that, that it blocked it. And evidence that I have, which we'll talk about in a little bit, is that really patients with new infections actually have been going undetected for the last 6 weeks or so.
So what are the weather factors that you're looking for? I mean, is it mostly the rain or lack of rain that is the determining factor?
Right. Well, there's a theory that is kind of talked about as the blow and grow theory. And basically the idea that when it rains on the Sonoran Desert, and the fungus, which causes valley fever, lives in basically desert Sonoran soils. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is when it rains, there's a bloom of the fungus, which then results in an increased crop of spores that can get into the air when things dry out. And so we see typically the increased activity of infections occurring when things get dry. Now, there's an incubation time of 1 to 3 weeks. So if it's dry and you get infected, you don't start feeling ill for, you know, 2 weeks on average. And then it's a week or two before you actually seek medical attention. So it's often through the monsoons that people are being diagnosed with valley fever. But those are infections that occurred maybe a month or 6 weeks earlier.
Which is interesting because if you think about, for example, monsoon season, it's pretty dry leading up to it.
Right. And so right now you would think, because it's been dry now for a period of time, this would be a very good time to see increasing numbers of infection. And I'm watching to see if that's the case.
Are we seeing more people actually getting tested for valley fever? I know in the past it's been something that a lot of physicians have maybe struggled to recognize or diagnose. Is that getting better?
Yes, it is. And I think it gets better with attention. This has not been happening just by chance. Because we have, at the University of Arizona in the colleges of medicine, have now affiliated with Banner Health, I've had the opportunity, and the Valley Fever Center people have had the opportunity to work with that large practice and start impacting their testing practices. And so over the last 4 years, I've been actually focused on urgent care, which when we started thinking about this, their testing of people with pneumonia, which is a very common presentation of Valley Fever, was like 1% or 2% of those patients being tested. And we've now gotten that up. This last 2 or 3 months, it's over 30%.
Hmm.
But that's still not quite as good as I'd like it. We'd like it more up towards 60%. I think that would be a good target.
And how reliable are the tests?
The tests are very specific when they're positive. However, they are designed to be very reliable, which means they typically miss cases. So people who have negative blood tests, and that's what we're really talking about here is a blood test, and that is typically positive, you got a diagnosis. In fact, the State Department of Health considers any positive a case definition. But if it's negative, you still might have it, and a repeat test may pick that up.
Hmm. So you mentioned the issue of awareness of Valley Fever, and I want to ask you about something that Banner is doing, this new dashboard to basically keep track of what's going on. How significant is that? And I guess why hasn't this happened in the past?
Well, I think it hasn't happened because the Valley Fever Center for Excellence is now working with a large group, Banner Health, and we have the opportunity to do this. It's having an advocate for this disease, which the Valley Fever Center is how it works. And it's a small disease compared to many others. The FDA calls it an orphan disease. And so if you really don't have people working on this, it just doesn't happen. So that's why I think it's happening now. The dashboard was my idea to move from this 25, 30% testing to give more feedback to the clinicians in urgent care. We're actually now extending it to Banner emergency rooms, which has implications for the hospital as well. So this idea of giving almost real-time data because the dashboard gets updated daily, and that then can be given to the urgent care docs and other clinicians in Banner. And we're actually making this public as well on the Valley Fever Center website. And that's very important because Public Health, Arizona Department of Health Service, actually showed that people who knew about Valley Fever before they got sick got a diagnosis sooner than people that didn't because they asked their clinician, don't you think I should be tested? So people knowing about this is just as important as having the clinicians know about it.
How are the treatment plans working? Like, do we have an effective treatment for Valley Fever at this point?
We have oral medicines. That the good news is they're not by intravenous injection. Mm-hmm. They're oral. And they are relatively safe. They have drug interactions. There's some problems with them. They have side effects. But we've been using them now for 35 years. The downside and the limitation is that they don't cure this disease. So people who get some of the most complicated Valley Fever, those patients are recommended to never stop treatment for the rest of their life. So they have lifelong treatment with that diagnosis. So we don't have a cure. So that would be really wonderful if we could find that. There's some possibles, but they're way, way in the future at the moment.
And in terms of potential vaccines, I know there have been trials on dogs. How have those gone, and are we potentially closer to having something for people?
Well, the idea of a vaccine has been around since the 1950s because it's been known that people who get over Valley Fever essentially never get second infections. So why not do the same kind of effect from a vaccine without having to wait for the infection? And that's been going on. I've been involved with trials and research ever since the 1970s. Very recently, over the last decade, at the University of Arizona, a vaccine has been discovered, which actually is very well along to become a product for veterinary use to prevent Valley Fever in dogs. And this has involved National Institutes of Health support. We have a partner company, Anavive Life Sciences in California, who has developed this along with us, helping them. And that's very exciting. But the idea that I have is the same vaccine. There's really no based on the science, no reason it couldn't also be for humans.
Hmm.
And we have submitted a grant, or at least Anavive and their collaborators, which includes us, have submitted a grant to the NIH requesting support to take the vaccine from where it is now into human trials. That was submitted last year. It's under consideration, and we're hopeful we'll hear something about that in the very near future.
All right. That is John Galgiani, director of the Valley Fever Center for Excellence. John, it's really nice to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. The group American Rivers is out with its 2024 list of the country's most endangered rivers. The rivers of New Mexico top the list, followed by those in Mississippi and Tennessee. But fourth on the list is Arizona's Santa Cruz River. The main threat, according to the report, water scarcity. My co-host Mark Brody talked more about this with Luke Cole, director of the Santa Cruz River Program at the Sonoran Institute. And they started with whether it was a surprise to Cole that the Santa Cruz River was on the list.
I was delighted that they nominated us because we nominated the river. So it didn't come as a complete surprise. We were very pleased and proud to offer up the river, but no, it wasn't a complete surprise in that we had been engaged in the nomination process all along.
So when you say that you are pleased, is that a matter of getting attention on it? I can't imagine you're thrilled that it's among the more endangered rivers in the country.
It cuts both ways, honestly. So pleased because the reason that we nominated the river is that it's very new in its recovery. You know, this is, I don't know how well the parallel works, but it's something like a toddler to a newborn. You know, this is a river that had been really battered for 100, 150 years, and only within the last 10 to 15 years has had any sort of rehabilitation. And it is because of how new and tender this recovery is that we thought that the river warranted nomination as threatened. It's threatened by its newness.
Is it safe to say, though, that the Santa Cruz River is doing better now than it was maybe 5 or 10 years ago?
That is absolutely the case. So the river has two major flowing sections. There's one closer to the border. We call that the Nogales Reach that flows south to north, as does the stretch up here in Pima County and the city of Tucson. Both of those have had upgrades to the wastewater treatment plants that create the water that is the Santa Cruz River in anywhere between 2008 and 2013. So it's really been since then that we've had clean water flowing in the river, and the river conditions on the whole are improving year after year following those upgrades.
What still concerns you about it, though? What do you still worry about?
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is that at least up here in the Tucson metropolitan area, we get the majority of our water from the Colorado River, right? It comes through the CAP. And as we see the continuing declines, unfortunately, of water in the Colorado River, that just sort of means that the pot of water that's available for Tucson and for anybody who's on the distribution system of the Colorado River, it's threatened. The good news is that the city of Tucson and really all of southern Arizona, and honestly a lot of Arizona, is doing fantastic work in water conservation. So the threat is sort of the broader existential one. The comfort comes from the fact that policymakers are making really good decisions around water conservation, which gives that much more confidence around the Santa Cruz River's continued rehabilitation.
It's interesting how the future of the Santa Cruz is so closely tied to the future of another, I think, endangered, threatened river, the Colorado.
That's absolutely correct. And it's the source water, at least for, again, for the Pima County stretch of the river. The stretch of the river down closer to the border, the majority of that water actually comes from the southern part of the watershed, much of which is in the state of Sonora, around Nogales, Sonora. So that's a fully different system. It's within the Colorado River's watershed. It's subject to a lot of the same climate change and development pressures that the rest of the Colorado River system is, but it does have something of a hydrological disconnect.
Oftentimes, I think when people think about threatened or endangered rivers, they think about things that people can do to try to clean them up or to protect them or to make them less threatened. Is that the case here? Like, are there things that people can do to help the Santa Cruz River, given, as you've discussed, sort of its relationship and in some ways reliance on another river?
There are, and they all really lie around water conservation and water technology measures. People have helped out tremendously over the past 30 plus years, taking Tucson here as a case study, the cumulative water use per year from the city of Tucson has not gone up since the middle of the 1980s. That's because elected officials, career officials, people who live here understand a water conservation mindset and are using less and less water per person per day. That's critically important. And as a result of that, we are continuing to see, you know, there's still enough water for the Santa Cruz River. And it's been really impressive decision-making around policy that has been made at the municipal, county, state, and federal levels, federal on in both sides of the border, to improve the water treatment trains that ultimately create the Santa Cruz River. So people are already doing that work. Another thing that people can do is to join this larger partnership that's been established here, a coalition of neighborhood groups, water practitioners, elected and career officials who are working to establish an urban national wildlife refuge for the entirety of the Santa Cruz River here. And that would bring, it would really leverage efforts to restore river flows and improve climate resiliency by bringing the federal government here to acquire land and to afford protections to this river that, again, is so early on in its recovery.
How optimistic are you that at some point in the future, the Santa Cruz River will not need to be on the most endangered or most threatened rivers list?
I am nothing but optimistic about it. I think that in reviewing the most endangered rivers listing for the Santa Cruz River, what you're going to see there is all of the good work that's happening down here in southern Arizona to protect and celebrate this river. The only threat to it really is, again, in how early on it is in its rehabilitation. So I have absolute confidence that the work that's already happening and has been happening over the last couple of decades will continue and will bring more attention to the river, get more people celebrating the history and the vibrancy and the ecology of this river, that will continue to encourage us to do the right thing to allow this river to flow and to recover. So I think it's going to be a really short amount of time before this river would be off the list.
All right. That is Luke Cole, director of the Santa Cruz River Program with the Sonoran Institute. Luke, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure. Nice talking to you, Mark.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger, and joining me in studio now is the show's Sam Dingman. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning. Lauren, I'm guessing you're familiar with the phrase social butterfly.
Sure, yeah.
That phrase brings to mind a certain kind of person, right?
Absolutely. I'm picturing someone who's sort of status-minded, maybe looking for an angle.
Exactly. There's a hint of self-interest to it. But I recently had a conversation that made me rethink that perception, because it turns out there is actually a biological definition of social insects, and they are nothing like this person we're imagining.
And that would include butterflies?
Well, according to Professor Anna Dornhaus at the University of Arizona, the most social insects are actually termites, wasps, bees, and ants.
Huh.
And Dornhaus runs an entire lab that studies this phenomenon of social insects, who, she says, are genetically engineered against self-preservation.
Huh.
They interact with each other constantly, but their whole focus is the preservation of the colony.
So completely unselfish socializing.
Imagine that. To human ears, it can be a little hard to believe. I wanted to ask you about a fascinating quote of yours I read in Arizona Highways, where you said, my broad argument is that ants and other social insects have collective strategies that have been optimized over millions of years. Collective strategies are not necessarily intuitive for humans.
So humans struggle with collective action problems all the time, right? So in human societies, precisely because we are evolved the quote-unquote normal way, the way that our brain is constructed, we are thinking of our individual benefits. For example, if you're thinking of a potluck, right, we all benefit if everybody brings a delicious dish to the potluck. And it's not a lot of work to make one dish, and then you get this amazing buffet. But one person might think, well, everybody else is bringing these amazing dishes. I'll just bring a bag of chips. That'll be much cheaper.
Right.
I should get an amazing buffet.
And, I think I've been the bag of chips person, so I'm cringing.
Okay, but the problem with the bag of chips, if there's one bag of chips person, it's not really a problem.
Right.
But then the other people see that and they're like, oh, that person just brought a bag of chips and I made, a roast chicken.
Yeah.
But I could also, next time I'll just bring a bag of chips. And that can lead to a kind of collapse of the whole thing.
Yeah. It makes me think of the whole not in my backyard debate, where you might have somebody who is, broadly speaking, in favor of a shelter for unhoused people, but they don't want that shelter to be built near their house.
Exactly. We always need kind of an external structure, for example, taxation or imposed order, to prevent these collective action problems from leading to a deterioration of the conditions for everybody.
Wow.
That's one way in which the ants have sort of a lead on us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
are ahead of the game. But there's another way that actually has nothing to do with cooperation or not cooperation. And that's what I was thinking of more in that quote.
Mm-hmm.
So when the ants are actually doing something, so for example, they want to collect food, and in order to collect food, they have to search for the food. And there's a very large area that they have to search in. The ants have evolved strategies for solving those problems.
Would this be the study I think I read about meandering?
Yes, what we are saying is they're sort of starting with a random walk, but then on the random walk, instead of just going in a random direction straight, they're doing this kind of left to right meander. So, as if you were regularly going a little bit left and then a little bit right and then forward and a little bit left again. So like a meandering river.
And then what would happen if one of these meandering ants was to discover food?
So when ants discover something interesting, food or a new nest site or an enemy or whatever, they usually go straight back to the nest and tell the others about it.
Huh.
And so this is another thing that we're interested in studying, is what information do they actually share?
Is that the dilemma that is behind one of the other very interesting quotes that I found on your website, which was, biological systems are often more noisy than engineered ones. However, they typically surpass artificial systems in their robustness to a wide variety of adversities.
Yeah, absolutely. So individual ants for sure make mistakes. They recruit to the wrong thing, or they forget where they were.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't necessarily know in detail why these failures happen. But if ants were just walking around randomly, that would be robust, but not very efficient. If the ants were always doing these systematic searches, that would be efficient, but it wouldn't be very robust. It would quickly become inefficient if you make any kind of errors.
Yeah.
And so we think that the meandering is just such a strategy that compromises between robustness and efficiency, and therefore achieves both.
Hmm. This is an odd association, but have you ever seen the movie Alien?
Yeah, with Sigourney Weaver.
Yes. Am I
a long time ago?
I just had this thought as you were describing that movie is sort of about the degree to which the human brain rejects this ant or social insect type of thinking. Because if you think about it, that movie is about this group of people who have been sent out into space to recover some compound and bring it back. They don't really know what the compound is or why they've been sent to retrieve it. And then on their way back, they get this message from a disembodied entity that they refer to, I think, as Mother, that has given them an order that says, nope, you've been redirected. You have to go over to this other planet and bring back this species that actually wants to kill all of you. But it's more important to our interests as a broader colony to understand this thing than it is for you guys to survive. And they rebel against that and they kill the thing that they're supposed to bring back for greater understanding. And if I'm understanding correctly, if we imagine a version of the movie Alien where all the characters are ants, they would have very willingly brought this thing back, even if it was going to kill all of them, because they would have had just this basic understanding that, like, it's better for the colony in the long term for this thing to come back. Mm-hmm. Ours is not to wonder why.
That's right. And we don't really know if they wonder why or not, or mm-hmm. if they know why. But yeah, in the literal sense, value the success of the colony over their own life or their own success. Humans often get a little depressed when I say they're not as altruistic as ants or bees are. Uh-huh. But I actually think that's the wrong way to think about it. I think we are, in fact, from a biologist's point of view, already incredibly altruistic, surprisingly close to social insects compared to chimpanzees, for example, or many other animals. Even those that do live in groups, humans are quite willing even to sacrifice life and limb, but certainly to invest in small and large ways in the communal good.
Right.
And so anthropologists debate why this is the case. Many biologists argue it has to do with the fact that we evolved in small groups of probably mostly related individuals. So in some ways, our brain is probably constructed to expect that most of the people immediately around us are our relatives, which we have some even biological interest in helping. Whatever the reason is, humans are actually quite willing to even pay fairly high costs to ensure the success of the group as a whole.
Right.
And that potluck story notwithstanding.
Right. for all the bag of chips guys out there, there's more roast chicken people.
Yes, there are a surprising number of roast chicken people. Otherwise, we wouldn't have the concept of potluck, right?
Right.
Otherwise, we would just say, bring a roast chicken or stay home.
Well, Professor Anna Dornhaus, this has been a fascinating conversation. I'm never going to look at an anthill the same way ever again.
Okay, wonderful.
All right, that'll do it for this Wednesday edition of the show. And we here at the show all want to say happy Juneteenth to everyone on this holiday. President Joe Biden declared it a national holiday in 2021, and there are celebrations throughout the valley, including an exhibition exploring the holiday's significance at the George Washington Carver Museum and Cultural Center in South Phoenix. Be sure to join us tomorrow on the show. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us. That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.